It gave one human being the ability to destroy cities, nations, entire civilizations. The president was accompanied everywhere by a military aide carrying the football, a briefcase that held the PSYOP decisions handbook, a list of secret command bunkers throughout the United States, and instructions on how to operate the emergency broadcast system. The PSYOP decisions handbook outlined various attack options, using cartoon-like illustrations to convey the details quickly. It was known as the Black Book. Eager to defend the civilian control of nuclear weapons from military encroachment, John F. Kennedy and Robert McNamara had fought hard to ensure that only the president could make the ultimate decision. But they hadn't considered the possibility that the president might be clinically depressed, emotionally unstable, and drinking heavily, like Richard Nixon during his final weeks in office. Amid the deepening Watergate scandal, Secretary of Defense Schlesinger told the head of the Joint Chiefs to seek his approval before acting on any emergency order coming from the president. Although Schlesinger's order raised questions about who was actually in command, it seemed like a good idea at the time. The Wrong Tape. 1 month after the inauguration of President Jimmy Carter, a member of his national security staff, General William E. Odom, attended briefings on the PSYOP at the headquarters of the Strategic Air Command in Omaha. Odom was considered a staunch anti-communist, one of the hardliners in the new administration. He was a Soviet expert, fluent in Russian, who'd attended West Point and trained as a tactical nuclear targeting officer for the Army. His visit to SAC headquarters occurred in February 1977. 8 years had passed since Henry Kissinger began to push for more flexibility in the PSYOP. Secretary of Defense Schlesinger had announced in 1974 that America's war plans were being revised, that they would soon include limited nuclear options and regional nuclear options using fewer weapons. And yet General Odom could find no trace of those changes in the PSYOP. Like others before him, nuclear initiates granted a secret knowledge. Odom was stunned by the PSYOP. "At times I simply could not believe what I was being shown and told, causing me to doubt my own comprehension. It was an unnerving experience for me personally. It was just a huge mechanical war plan aimed at creating maximum damage without regard to the political context. I concluded that the United States had surrendered political control over nuclear weapons to a deterministic theory of war that ensured an unprecedented devastation of both the Soviet Union and the United States, and the president would be left with two or three meaningless choices that he might have to make within 10 minutes after he was awakened after a deep sleep late some night. A policy of launch on warning was absurd and irresponsible, and implementing the PSYOP under any conditions would be the height of folly. The PSYOP now called for the Soviet Union to be hit with about 9,000 nuclear weapons. But what disturbed Odom the most about the Joint Strategic Target Planning staff in Omaha was that they didn't seem to have any post-attack plans. Things would just cease in their world about 6 to 10 hours after they received the order to execute the PSYOP. President Carter was determined to end the arms race with the Soviet Union, and he knew more about nuclear weapons than any of his predecessors at the White House, except perhaps Eisenhower. Carter had attended the U.S. Naval Academy, served as an officer on submarines, and helped to design the first nuclear propulsion systems for the Navy. A few weeks before his inauguration, Carter had met with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and asked them an unexpected question. How long would it take to reduce America's nuclear arsenal to just 100 or 200 ballistic missiles? The room fell silent, and no answer was given. In that moment, President Carter had revealed himself to be an advocate of minimum deterrence, a strategy that the Navy had endorsed in the late 1950s as the Polaris submarine was being developed. He thought that 100 or 200 missiles might be sufficient to deter the Soviets. And if both superpowers reduced their strategic forces to those levels, neither could launch a successful first strike. During his inaugural address, Carter spoke about his ultimate goal, the elimination of all nuclear weapons from this Earth. To make sure the issue was never far from his mind, he kept wooden miniatures of Soviet and American missiles on his desk in the Oval Office. The Joint Chiefs of Staff regarded Carter with suspicion. The new president not only supported minimum deterrence, he also sought a ban on all nuclear testing. He proposed large cuts in military spending. He sincerely wanted new arms control agreements, world peace, friendship with the Soviet Union, and he appointed Harold Brown, one of McNamara's former whiz kids, to serve as Secretary of Defense. Brown thought that the United States hadn't fallen behind the Soviets and that new strategic weapons, like the B-1 bomber, weren't urgently needed. Within weeks of taking office, Carter found his plans opposed by most Republicans, many Democrats, the armed services, and even the Soviets. At the Kremlin, his proposal to accelerate the reduction of ballistic missiles seemed like an attempt to gain favorable publicity, and his criticism of human rights violations in the Soviet Union were regarded as insulting. The Soviet leadership much preferred dealing with Nixon and Kissinger, who never mentioned the repression of dissidents. A new organization, the Committee on the Present Danger, soon attacked the Carter administration for being weak on defense and endangering the security of the United States. The group's membership included academics, defense intellectuals, former government officials, and retired military officers. They warned that within a few years the nation would face a window of vulnerability, a period in which the Soviets might be able to launch a surprise attack that spared American cities but destroyed all of its land-based missiles. The president would then face an agonizing choice: accede to the demands of the Soviet Union and save American lives, or launch submarine-based missiles at Soviet cities and cause pointless mutual annihilation. The committee's views were succinctly expressed in an essay by Richard Pipes, a history professor at Harvard and one of the group's founders, "Why the Soviet Union Thinks It Could Fight and Win a Nuclear War." The Soviets were violent, deceitful, authoritarian, and cunning, Pipes argued, and they'd already shown a willingness to commit mass murder on behalf of communism. The downfall of the United States now seemed within their grasp, and would be pursued regardless of the cost.